Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday. It's the 5th of May, and we're very happy that you are with us. 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, listening to the music this morning of Trey Anastasio, who was a collaborator often with Capital Region and Saratoga bassist Tony Markellis, who died late last week. He was 68 years old, and we're going to be playing tracks this morning from Trey Anastasio's album The Horseshoe Curve, as the two often collaborated and played on the album. Also, a quick note that yesterday it was announced that Trey would be doing 3 solo acoustic shows at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center on June 18th, 19th, and 20th. That was announced yesterday and will be, I think they go on sale on Friday, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, a lot, we remember the wonderful Tony Markellis this morning, and we'll be hearing that music throughout our program. Let me introduce everybody to you and get going here. We welcome your letters, of course, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Well, I guess I'm okay. You know, the greatest thing in the world now, one of the great advances, which we don't recognize, is weather reporting. And if you go online, you can find out it's gonna rain from 6 to 7, and then 7 to 9, it's not going to rain, and after 9, it is going to rain. I tell you that, Joe, because I walk according to the weather forecast, because I'd rather not be in the rain. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So did you get it in today without... With no issues. Excellent.
Very good. No issues. No.
That's good. Excellent. Excellent reporting. All right. Let's go to investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning. How is everyone? Happy to be here.
Very, very nice. Very good to be here. We're very nice to have you here. Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. I'm good. I'm a little tired of the rain too, but I'm otherwise fine.
Fantastic. We also go to Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, everybody. Happy Cinco de Mayo. And if anybody's wondering, I'm still not banned on Facebook, unlike somebody else.
That's right. Facebook justified in banning Donald Trump, the social media's oversight board has ruled. While the panel upheld Facebook's suspension of the former president, it said the company's indefinite ban was wrong and gave Facebook 6 months to either ban Trump permanently or reinstate him. So, why is that significant? Who wants that one?
Let's go to Rosemary.
Because he has a big, awful mouth, and he keeps telling lies, and he shouldn't be given a place to do that easily. I hope that they will consider carefully a permanent ban, but I'll take the next 6 months of silence as happily as I took the last 5 months that we've not had him around. It's made a big difference. Facebook actually did more to... and the Trump, allure than the U.S. Congress. And so I'm very happy to hear they did this today.
Bob Griffin.
Yeah, I think Facebook first did the right thing. And if you're questioning why, I mean, basically Donald Trump was yelling fire in a crowded theater. He was pushing an insurrection, and I hope that there's additional actions that are taken about and around January 6th. So that has nothing as much to do with Facebook, but it is linked with this whole story. Part of the conversation I know that we've had many times on the show and on other shows on WAMC is this whole changing nature of both media, social media, and disinformation. And this is going to be something that's with us for a long time. But kudos to Facebook for actually standing up and doing what is right.
Chris Churchill.
Well, first of all, I like the fact that Bob said he still hasn't been banned from Facebook, as if he's expecting it to happen any day now.
I remember every day, any moment,
Facebook page to see,
keeps
to see
checking
what
his email.
Yeah. But I agree with Rosemary. I mean, since since Donald Trump has been off Twitter and off Facebook, it kind of has felt like, you know, it's been kind of nice not to log onto those sites and see his rantings. I mean, I do take it that there are free speech issues that are raised, but Facebook is a private company that can decide who it wants to host on its platform. You know, if people have problems with that, then, you know, they have to find a different website, I guess.
Well, and they follow, well, I'm going to say this with a bit of a irony. I mean, they have rules to follow, and you're supposed to play by the rules when you go on the site. So
there are a lot of people who don't, in fairness.
That's right.
A lot of people
exactly.
who spread lies and misinformation there that they don't crack down on. There's a lot of racist abuse of, you know, celebrities and athletes and stuff and social media platforms that they don't crack down. There's a lot more that they could do.
All right, so let's get to a somewhat...
Wait, I didn't go yet.
I'm sorry. I started with you, and then I thought you...
I know. You started with me, and then I said, let's go to Rosemary, because she always has something great to say. But I thought I would say one thing that will make people as angry at me as usual, and that is that as soon as the Republicans get in, they're going to look at Joe Biden and say, we want him banned also. So free speech, and I know Rosemary and Chris and everybody understand this, free speech is not something to be played with. I think people know, I think that what did Trump in was that he was an idiot and he was a lying liar. And he was a terrible guy. But what happens is that when you ban somebody from speaking, A, you create an appetite for the other side, and clearly there is another side. 73 million people voted that way, right? And I think that we have to take this free speech thing very, very seriously.
Chris?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Facebook is a private company. They don't have to host somebody they don't want to host. I mean, part of free speech and free assembly and being a free American is the right to say, I don't want. I mean, part of free speech is being able to say, I don't agree. I don't want to host this opinion. I don't want to have, you know, it's like if you have the right to throw somebody out of your living room, a private company has the right to throw somebody off of its platform. And I realize social media is, it's kind of a new, it's so pervasive that it's hard for people to see it as a private company that has the right to do what it wants, but it does have that right. And that, you know, if you were to say that Facebook had to host Donald Trump, you'd be violating its free speech rights. The same way you'd be violating the Times Union's free speech rights if you said we had to publish such and such an editorial.
Rosemary?
I think I'm really tired of the Republicans controlling what happens by holding that very real specter of what's to come that Alan just reminded us. You're like, okay, you can do this now, but wait till we get in. And I think the real answer here is we have to work as Democrats to make sure that they don't get in. We need to reverse the usual formula that in a midterm, the party in power is going to be thrown out and lose seats. That cannot happen this time. There is as much at stake in 2022 as there was in 2020. And this is another good reminder. I think big tech will be raked over the coals if Republicans get any more power than they have already. And while some regulation, some sort of control, if you will, might be a good idea, it can't come from government. It's got to come from, as I've said all along, a joint government tech industry work group that sets up rules that everyone can live with. It is an extraordinary measure taken to shut off Donald Trump, and there is no one else like him. Joe Biden is president, but that's the only way that he's the same as Trump, and there has to be some way to recognize that in the rules that we set for ourselves going forward.
Bob?
Well, I hope,
I'm sorry, Bob. Alan made a comment. Because I absolutely agree, Alan, that we need to continue to have robust conversations about protecting our First Amendment rights. I would say, though, I was thinking about your comment, and I can't remember a direct tweet from Joe Biden. So if he got banned, I don't think it would change anything.
I don't think he would care.
That, I appreciate the fact that Biden isn't on and that information from the administration is coming through the more official channels.
And Alan, you were going to say?
No, I mean, look, the Democrats just lost an election in Texas, a very important congressional election. I fully understand what everybody's saying. And, you know, I love the idea that I don't have to listen to Trump. But I do think there is a possibility here that the Republicans are going to control both the House and the Senate now, and that they will mount a counter to the Biden presidency in a couple of years. So I don't know what to say except that, you know, it's playing with fire, and I don't know what else there is to say.
Josh says, hooray for Alan. Free speech should not be fooled around with, quoting you. Thanks for stating this. The new normal is reading newspaper pieces about our president's dogs. Is Biden bringing out the best in our journalists? Thank you for the program, says Josh.
Oh, that is so unfair. There were tons of stories about how Trump did not have a dog. So, of course, there's going to be cute little features. And hold on to your hat. You're going to see stuff about what Jill Biden is wearing. And she could use some work, by the way. But that is not the sum and total or the most important part of what journalists are writing about in the Biden administration. There's lots more good news than we've written about in a while, but it's substantial. It's about the economy. It's about leadership. There is some severely good journalism going on. So that letter, I call it a horrible letter.
Well, I liked it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the hooray for Alan part was good. We like that part. Chris Churchill is our other resident journalist on the panel.
Well, I've written about Biden's dog, so I'll try not to take that. Two dogs, the two German shepherds. I'll try not to take that personally. But, I do take the letter writer's point. I do think, well, sometimes when I read the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are not the only newspapers out there, despite what some Republicans try to claim, I sometimes do think their coverage could be a little more pointed, their coverage of Biden. It has been pretty soft so far. But on the other hand, it really hasn't given them many controversies to write about. There are other newspaper outlets that are, and the Wall Street Journal would be one, that are reporting more aggressively. So, I don't think that the totality of the coverage out there is only about Biden's dogs.
We go to this letter from Christopher, who says, this sounds snarky, but I promise it's not. Why would anyone impute or assume good faith on Facebook's part? Why is this even a debate?
It's a really interesting question, Joe, because there's a lot of truth in that. And I assumed when I saw that Facebook was meeting about this, I assumed that they were going to return his full-time status and was more an economic rather than a political or free speech issue. So I do cast a wary eye on Facebook and what their true motives are.
Scott writes, as a libertarian-leaning Trump supporter, I'm not in disagreement that Facebook has the right to remove Trump. I wonder if the panel has the intellectual integrity to say they support the Christian couple who own a bakery refusing to bake a wedding cake for a homosexual couple.
I support their constitutional right to do it, but I deplore that they have done it.
I'm with you.
Ronnie says Facebook is a business. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just don't draw a connection between the two. I understand. I mean, I can conceptualize what the letter writer is saying about the two speeches, but I'm thinking about the volume, the veracity, the violence that came from Trump's social media that you can't equate back to the bakery situation.
And one more letter before we go to a break. Facebook is a business, says Ronnie. Republicans fought for the right for businesses to refuse service to people for any reason. Hilarious watching it turn on them. That from Ronnie.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the two cases, the cake bakers and Facebook, are similar. We're talking about basic constitutional rights. One is religious freedom. One is freedom of expression, both in the First Amendment. It's the right of a private company to do something we would never allow our government to do. And there is an argument on the other side, whether you agree with it or not, that ought to be listened to. So I do find the two cases similar and worth comparing. And, that's it.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. I want to talk about Liz Cheney. Let's get to that story. And a lot of interesting information coming out about that this morning. So we'll talk about that. We welcome your letters. We always do. We've gotten, we've already gotten to many, and we'll get to many more as we go through the morning. Panel@WAMC.org. We just ask that you are short and to the point, and you pre-read your letters so we know what you are actually trying to communicate to the masses. Panel@WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Bob Griffin on the program this morning. We will continue our conversation after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, Rosemary Armeo, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. This from the New York Times. The first time defenders of Donald J. Trump came for Representative Liz Cheney for the offense of having voted to impeach him. Fellow Republicans closed ranks to save her leadership post, with Representative Kevin McCarthy boasting that their Big Tent Party had enough room for both the former president and a stalwart critic. Evidently not anymore. Just 3 months after she beat back a no-confidence vote by lopsided margins, Cheney of Wyoming, the number three House Republican, is facing a far more potent challenge that appears increasingly likely to end in her ouster from leadership. This time, Mr. McCarthy, the minority leader, is encouraging the effort to replace her. Her transgression? Ms. Cheney's continued public criticism of Mr. Trump, her denunciation of his lies about a stolen election, and her demands that the GOP tell the truth about how his supporters assaulted democracy during the January 6th riot at the Capitol. My goodness, how dare she? Meanwhile, the number two House Republican, Steve Scalise, the House GOP whip, issued a statement this morning backing Representative Elise Stefanik for the post. It's the first public statement from Republican leadership that Cheney should be ousted. Stefanik is a prodigious party fundraiser for New York's 21st district. And it would be interesting, of course, to see where this goes, but the story has a local connection as well. Alan.
Well, I think it's already over. I'm sure that they're all lining up to do that, and Stefanik will get it. Of course, there is going to be a potential gerrymander here. We don't know where Stefanik will end up, but I assume she's going to be the hero of the right-wing pro-Trumpian party, even though she started out as a moderate. She is now full-blown in terms of, her support for the ex-president and the right-wing Republicans.
Whenever
it's done.
Whenever Chris Churchill writes about Elise Stefanik, I'm in. I can't wait to read about that. So, sir, please share your comments on this particular story.
Yeah, should I save them for the next column, or you want to hear it?
No, I want a preview. Yeah.
Well, come on, forget the column.
Well, I mean, it's amazing, right? Who could have imagined a point where Liz Cheney would be essentially excommunicated from, you know, the Republican Party? I know they're not kicking her out of the party, but it's pretty close. And you wonder if this is tenable, if she can stay within the party. I mean, there certainly seems to be a breakup happening, you know, and basically what the party leadership is saying, what the party is saying, is that, you know, you have to participate in this lie to keep your job. It's a litmus test. You know, you either have to spout the lie yourself or just keep silent about it. And Liz Cheney, to her credit, has not been willing to do that. You mentioned fundraising, Joe, and I think that is a big part of this. I would imagine, you know, these are leadership positions, but they're also fundraising positions. That's a big part of what those people are expected to do. And I would imagine that, just from hearing some of the comments from Republicans that I know, that Liz Cheney's ability to fundraise has probably collapsed, while Elise Stefanik is, you know, a fundraising juggernaut. And
but Chris, you know, you don't think she's stupid, do you? I mean, she has to know what was going to happen to her, Cheney here. So and what was going to be likely to happen? I think she is, of course, a representative from the Bushian part of the family, of the Republican family, and they can't stand Trump. And her father was a vice president. I don't see this as she's got to know what was going to happen.
Well, she may have. Maybe she just doesn't care anymore, or maybe she really is, you know,
principled.
Really does think this is a defining moment.
Integrity.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Wow.
But I do think this will be one of those moments that history books are written about, obviously. And, you know, I do think that any politician should want to be on the right side of the issue. I commend her for doing that. I've had a lot of, you know, I don't really love the war hawk side of the Republican Party that the Cheneys have obviously represented. But, you know, I do commend her for standing up for what she thinks is right in this situation. And I'll say, too, that the document that she produced, I think it's like a 25-page document refuting all of the Trump election claims and going through all the court cases has been really helpful. I mean, both as a journalist and as somebody who likes to send it to friends who doubt the veracity of the election, that is a service that she provided.
With keeping in mind what Chris just mentioned, Rosemary, it does, I think, bear asking the question of what happened in the last 3 months. You have she beats a no confidence vote 3 months ago, and now she's on the verge of ouster.
Well, we all have taken this view, which I heartily disagree with, that, okay, get over Trump. He's out. We'll move on. And I don't think that's really been happening in the Republican Party at all. I think Trump has dug in. I think he retains lots of financial and philosophical control over his party. If fundraising, and I agree with Chris, is as important as it is. He's the real, that's where the money is. And so if you want to be a powerful Republican these days, you kiss his ring. So in the last 3 months, you've seen that weak-kneed, yellow-bellied, stupid man, McCarthy. What a weak man he is. First, did the right thing and said, yes, Trump was responsible, and then crawls down to Florida and kisses the ring. And now he's had it with Liz Cheney, please. You have Scalise, who was shot himself and yet will not even consider any kind of gun regulation. What a terrible lineup it is. And that cannot in the long run be good. But in the short term, it just bodes horribly. I don't think there's a real civil war in the party. I think the party has completely capitulated to Trump. And that has become increasingly clear over the last 3 months. And Liz was given a chance to modify in the same way that Kevin McCarthy did, say, oh, well, you know, okay, let's move on. That horrible thing, let's move on, is the worst thing we can do. We should be concentrating on what's going on. She didn't. And I give her lots of power. I also hate the Cheney-Bush branch of the Republican Party, but I never thought of them as dishonest or weak or submissive to a corrupt human being, which I do believe is Trump. And so I do applaud her for that. Scalise, man, Lee Stefanik. I wish I were in North Country so I could work against her. I may do it anyway. It's just bald. It's bald what she's done to change her mind about, well, everything, right? Trump, she criticized him back in 2016, and now she's his little handmaiden, and she's doing this for what reason? To rise up in the Republican Party. Wow. But she has made a name for herself. Aren't we all so proud in New York that we gave her to the country?
Bob, not only that, she may end up as a vice presidential candidate. Don't kid yourself. She may.
And, you know, and just to, go ahead, Bob.
I just know one ticket that I'm definitely voting against then.
Is there a possibility? There's a possibility you would have voted for Trump otherwise, right?
Yeah.
I'm just being a wise guy.
Go ahead, Bob. Your thoughts on this.
You know, it's really interesting because we just spent the first section show talking about free speech and Facebook. And I can tell you that the amount of time that we just spent on it is exponentially more time than the GOP leadership in the House has spent thinking about and struggling with the issue of free speech. It shows a level of depravity and control that is in the GOP right now. And I would argue that while it is more homogeneous today than it was 3 months ago, it is a smaller party. I do think that there is an opportunity to start to talk about a third party system, especially as what was once principled GOP moves further and further to the right and further and further into Trump land. We haven't really talked about it, but the GOP and the House GOP, they have a woman problem. They have a problem with if you look at the diversity of their own membership, support of female candidates. So they have to. I think they have to if they replace Cheney with another female. Otherwise, it's going to be all white men. And I think that's part of the image that is going to cost them the suburbs if they're not careful. You know, Joe, Stefanik is she's a swamp creature. You know, when we're talking about the worst things in D.C., I mean, she's a living example of someone who has sold out her ideals in order to achieve power. It is everything that is wrong with Washington right now.
You know, I'm also just struck, and Chris, I guess you follow her comings and goings quite closely, but you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, her spokesman was saying that she's actively thinking about running for governor. I assume that's out the window.
Yeah, well, Lee Zeldin seems to have taken that opportunity away from her. He seems to really be the front runner, and the party stupidly seems to be coalescing around him. I think it's, you know, political suicide. I think they'll get crushed, and I think if Andrew Cuomo will win a fourth term pretty easily if Lee Zeldin is his opponent. But I do think that they were looking at that. I do think that she was looking at that, but it's just not an opportunity now that she can. She and Zeldin would be pretty much in the same lane of the party. It's just hard to see them both, not canceling each other out. It is disheartening to see this really cynical game that she played pay off, and it does seem as though it is going to pay off. You know, she is, people should, if you look into her, she's very much of the Bush-Cheney wing of the party, and she still pretty much votes that way. But on the election and on her tone, she has gone full Trump, and that has paid off for her, or it seems to be on the verge of paying off.
Rosemary?
Well, that's always been the case. Trump himself got away with murder, so she's a quick learner, if nothing else. But I have to say that I hate this idea of the little catfight going on between Liz Cheney and Elise Stefanik, that the Republican Party, well, politics in general, give this one little piece to women, and so they're battling over it. I mean, aside from how she's abandoned all of her principles, she certainly is not supporting a fellow woman Republican, of which she has gotten some fame and recognition. She's the one who promotes more women coming to the Republican Party, and she's now going up against a very competent, very powerful woman herself. It's so hypocritical on a whole different level.
We will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. We're getting many, so we'll get to those in just a few minutes. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with our panel, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Bob Griffin. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Bob Griffin. Let's go to letters that we have. Ken writes, I suspect that the place where we will see the real split in Republican identity will be between how corporate money behaves versus ideological money. The right wing radical ideologues have the microphone right now, but more moderate corporate money and interests will win out, says Ken. Then we go to Rosemary. What gives? Where are the weapons of mass destruction? How large a price has this country paid based on the real big lie, the U.S.-Iraq war? The lie was Cheney and Bush.
Okay, so, yeah, you're right.
All right.
Was a lie. So it's the lie that the election was stolen. I'm an equal opportunity critic of lying by government.
I
don't get your point.
I don't either. So we were talking about how the president, former right. president of the United States, 45, no longer has Twitter or Facebook. However, he does release press releases, and one just came over at 9:49, so 1 minute and 12 seconds ago. This is a statement from Donald J. Trump. Warmonger Liz Cheney, who has virtually no support left in the great state of Wyoming, continues to unknowingly and foolishly say there was no election fraud in the 2020 presidential election when, in fact, the evidence, including no legislative approvals as demanded by the U.S. Constitution, shows the exact opposite. Had Mike Pence referred the information on six states, only needing two, back to state legislatures and had gutless and clueless minority leader Mitch McConnell, he blew two seats in Georgia that should never have been lost, fought to expose all of the corruption that was presented at the time with more found since, we would have a far different presidential result and our country would not be turning into a socialist nightmare. Never give up. I read that just in case you were missing what he had to say.
And Joe, I think I was just rereading online that the I think I got this right, maybe not, the Facebook oversight board that they have has ruled in their favor, saying, yes, they were justified in kicking Trump off. People were waiting for that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that different than what we were talking about at the beginning?
Well, I think it just happened. I mean, there's this board that they have appointed. Maybe I've got this all bollocked up, that they have appointed to watch what's going on at Facebook. And they are basically saying this is the right thing. They did the right thing, as opposed to saying, no, everybody has a right to speak.
Let's see. Let's go to some other letters here. We have some stuff on Facebook as well as Bob, were you going to say something? I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you?
Yeah, it's just I was just listening to Trump's comments, and I just it's Alice in Washington land, isn't it? I mean, it's so delusional, and this idea that people are buying into this big lie is actually beyond me. I just have such a hard time comprehending what, you know, how you get yourself to believe such a, you know, such a falsehood. I didn't miss
a lot of people. An awful lot of people believe it. You saw what happened in the election.
That's scary, and
I don't think there'd be a difference now.
Suzanne says we shouldn't worry about what the GOP will do in response. They'll do something awful no matter what. That in regards to Facebook. Mark says someone once said that freedom is the recognition of necessity. Let's recognize that it was necessary to shut up the lying liar once and for all. Jen writes, I think secretly the Republicans within the government want Trump to be kept off social media. It will be much easier for all of them to run for office without him on social media trying to derail their campaigns. Don't be fooled. Even Ted Cruz, Ron DeSantis, and anyone else considering a run for president in 2024 will want him banned.
Yeah, and there's not a single moral bone in any of the bodies of the people that were just mentioned in that letter. So you're absolutely correct. They're the very worst of the swamp.
And Joe, if we could go back for a second to the idea that there's going to be a third party. It takes an awful lot to have a third party. We've found that out in the past, and I suspect it's going to be, again, people have always thought there would be, but I don't see how that happens. If it does happen, it's certainly going to hurt the Republicans more than the Democrats.
Carol writes, of course, there hasn't. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, real quick. Alan, I think you make a really interesting point, and the only pathway that I really see is if the business money completely dries up and goes into sort of that third party category. But the money has got to be there. That's going to be the key if anything is going to change.
Okay, so let's assume that happens, and the big money goes into a third party. How does that help the Republicans? It doesn't. It just splits them even further.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't help the Republicans, but it does create sort of a more middle ground, which I think would be really interesting to watch.
I do think it, the Democrats get hurt too, Alan, when you consider that if someone like Liz Cheney ran in a third party, Democrats who are very uncomfortable with Biden's unexpected progressiveness would have a place to turn to. Not many people are happy with the fact that so far he doesn't appear to be exactly the centrist that he presented himself to be during the election. So a third party is not good for Republicans or Democrats.
Well, we can all discuss this as we go, but I think it's very good for the Democrats and very bad for the Republicans.
Evelyn writes, how can we Democrats support Ms. Cheney? What can we do to keep her in politics? I am a tree-hugging socialist Democrat that thinks she is one in a million. Jay says, the case of the bakers refusing to bake a cake for a gay couple is about civil rights and discrimination, not free speech. Your right to practice your religion is not a blanket that exempts you from abiding by all other laws with which you don't agree. That is not at all comparable to the former president's irresponsible and even treacherous use of social media platforms under the guise of free speech. That from Jay. We go to Mike, who says, in regard to a great many subjects,
And Joe, while you're at it, something's coming across CNN as we watch it right now, saying that the Facebook Oversight Board has ruled in favor of it. So this really was an issue. People were waiting to see what that oversight board would do, and they have ruled in Facebook's favor.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Mike says, in regard to a great many subjects, I heard Alan say that Democrats should not do X because if they do, the Republicans will turn around and do X to them. In nearly every case, the Republicans are already doing X. In the few remaining cases, you can be sure the Republicans will do X, whether the Democrats do it or not. The effect is to clip one's wings to prevent the other side from doing it. Democrats, spread your wings and fly. Fight the Republicans in every imaginable way. They will stop at nothing to destroy you. Do not inhibit yourselves. Then Bob says, isn't Stefanik's seat in danger of being gerrymandered out of existence? I'm pretty sure I heard that on the roundtable this week. Well, we don't know, right?
I don't see how it happens. Chris, it could be, but I don't see how it happens. There are two Republican seats up there, so I don't – I go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry.
No, it is hard to see how they would draw it. They'd have to split up the North Country, essentially. And she lives at the very edge of the district. One thing that will probably happen is that she will no longer live in the district when it's redrawn. But I think that there will still be.
That's when you get the moving van. That's when you get the moving van, right?
Yeah, but I think there will still be a safe North Country Republican district. It's hard to see. I mean, I suppose if they got really creative, they could do it, but then there would be all sorts of court challenges and everything else. It's hard to see that she'll be gerrymandered out of existence.
She's also popular up there. I hate to say it, but she is.
Yeah.
Ann writes, once again, it's all about the money. Stefanik has a $2.5 million war chest, and that is the key to her elevation in the party. Meanwhile, Northern Madison County will again await our fate come September as we have been bounced back and forth between districts. Tenney has been totally silent. I work to elect Brindisi and will work to defeat either woman. Then we have this. Last letter before we go to a break. Bill writes, while the GOP may be getting smaller, its underlying strength is the financial support it receives from single issue and corporate interests. Promising the relaxation of environmental rules will assure the flow of Koch money as well as fossil fuel multinationals. This money will continue to provide the fuel that stokes the fires of division in the country. A solution to this is the overturning of Citizens United. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with other subjects. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Rosemary Armeo, and Bob Griffin. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. So Janet Yellen's comments on inflation spark confusion. Clarification as White House tries to navigate economic pressures. The Treasury Secretary tried to stamp out inflation fears that have grown among some economists and business leaders. Here's the story from the Washington Post. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen insisted Tuesday that she is not concerned about the risks of economic overheating hours after her earlier comments about inflation caused a brief panic on Wall Street and invited fresh scrutiny about the White House's position. The confusion sparked by the Treasury chief showed the delicate situation the Biden administration confronts as it seeks to demonstrate its attention to inflationary pressures without fueling criticism that its spending packages could hurt the economy. In an interview with The Atlantic that was released Tuesday morning, Yellen defended the administration's new spending proposals and said the central bank could handle inflationary pressures with modest interest rate increases. The Fed sets interest rate policy, but Yellen has a unique vantage point, having led the central bank at the end of the Obama administration and beginning of the Trump administration. Raising interest rates can slow the pace of economic growth by increasing the cost of borrowing, a tool for fighting inflation. Alan.
Well, let's hope she's right. You know, I don't know that stuff. She's been close to it. She says we can handle it. We can raise the interest rates if we have to. I remember, I think I mentioned this the other day, when we got our first mortgage in Alford, Massachusetts, it was for 13%, I believe. So now we're at nothing. They have lots of room to move ahead if they want to, if inflation takes over. It's hard not to see when we're spending all of this money that there won't be some inflation. The only question is, if there is it worth it?
Bob.
I think that a couple of key words in this is that it's because of a superheated economy, and the fact that some are trying to link this back to Biden's policy that I think ignores the fact that it's a superheated economy. The economy is really moving in the right direction. I mean, you can feel it when you're out. On the show before, and when I say before, I even want to go back, you know, a year plus, we talked about the Fed and how the Fed had, artificially kept the interest rates low, historic lows, as Alan just said. I think it's too low. And I also think that because of the policies under the Trump administration, there are few tools left in the Fed's toolbox to deal with inflation. So I personally think that we are going to see an increase in interest rates. I think it will be, on the margins. And it's meant not to kill the economy, but to actually make sure the economy is healthy in the future.
Rosemary?
I wish Terry Gibson were here to field this question, because I don't think it's an economic issue at all. I think this was Yellen made a communications error. She's asked about inflation. She goes, no, I'm not worried about it. But even if it happened, the Fed could deal with this easily. And Wall Street, in its typical unnuanced, blundering way, said, oh, my God, Janet Yellen is talking about inflation. It's a problem. And hence you end up with panic and she has to walk it back. I don't think it ever is anything more than that. She was just saying, look, it's not a big deal. Even if it were, we could deal with it. And that got blown up into something way beyond that. I don't think that there's a problem with inflation. We've not seen it. We've not seen it happening with some really huge government spending over the past year. And like I said, just communication. She's got to learn how to be a secretary of Treasury rather than head of the central bank.
Chris.
Yeah, I guess I agree it was a communications error, but I would say it was a pretty minor one. It's almost difficult for me to understand what the kerfuffle is about. I mean, what she said was so modest, and so it's not like she, predicted some sort of doom and gloom. But like Rosemary said, Wall Street does tend to overreact to things, and this would certainly be an example of that. I'm not an economist. I have no idea whether all this federal spending will result in inflation. I guess it could, but as others have said, interest rates have been artificially low for a very, very long time. And, you know, there's a downside to that too, as anyone with a, you know, who tries to open a savings account or, you know, will know that, you know, there are pluses and minuses to interest rates rising a little bit.
So Joe, if I could jump on Chris's comment,
absolutely. I think
this has as much or more to do with Biden's infrastructure and education plans and the GOP lining up or members of the GOP lining up to try to regain the mantle of fiscal hawks after they completely blew the budget, under Trump. The one thing I find interesting about the argument, though, is the part of the reason the economy is really doing well is because of the stimulus that the federal government has put in place. And I think that gets lost in this overall conversation. Like you, I think it was a minor throwaway comment. It also shows you the power of the secretary that even a musing can have enormous impact on the market, and it's really difficult. You can't afford to say the wrong things.
All right, let's move on if we can and go to other stories here. We will go to this one, which is we talked a little bit about yesterday in not this specific aspect of the story, but of course about coronavirus and what's being done and about goals of the White House. So now the president has set new vaccine goals as the White House has grappled with its messaging. We talked about that messaging yesterday. So yesterday, the president declared a new goal that 70% of adults will have at least one coronavirus vaccine shot by the 4th of July as the White House grappled with how to send Americans a complex message. A normal life is within reach if you get vaccinated, but the crisis is far from over, so don't fully relax your guard. Biden has been accused of sending mixed messages recently by continuing to wear a mask outside despite official guidance that he doesn't need to, since he is fully vaccinated. The White House is reaching out to scientists and public health experts to understand how the science is evolving as more people get vaccinated and which restrictions they can and cannot relax, according to people familiar or engaged in the conversation. Alan.
Well, you know, he's a smart guy to set this new objective of the 70% and what's happening. I think that's the right thing to do. It's worked up until now. He's put out the way that he thinks we ought to be going, and he's met those goals. So he's doing it again. And, you know, he's going to get a lot of credit for what he's done here in any case. I don't think anybody's going to bring him down over all of this. But I think he's right to continue on, because this is his big achievement that he's gained since he's been the president.
Bob.
And just some numbers for everybody. You know, yesterday, there was 40,500 new cases of COVID, and while we like to think that we're beyond, 890 Americans died just yesterday from COVID.
Right.
We are not out of the woods yet. And my fear, and I share comments that I heard from Fauci yesterday on CNN, is we can't drop the baton at the end. You know, he was asked by Wolf Blitzer, you know, what inning do you think we are if this is a baseball game? Because both of them are huge baseball fans. And he said bottom of the sixth. That means that there's an awful lot of time that we still have got to pay attention. I like the re-messaging. I like the fact that they're shifting their strategy away from sort of the huge mass vaccination to try to push the vaccine availability further and further into the communities. I think all of that is incredibly smart. The fear that I hear from folks is the concern about the number and percentage of Americans that aren't going back for their second shot. And I think there's a lot of science and research that has to go on to tell us what exactly the impact is. But the numbers are pretty considerable. You know, finally, and I'll toss this out for consideration. I totally appreciate the balancing act that has got to come out of the White House. This idea of caution versus optimism. However, when you look at the variants and what's occurring in India, I mean, this thing is not over yet. And we need to remain prudent. And I hate to think that all of the sacrifices made was lost at the end.
Rosemary?
I like that Biden and his team keep switching it up, that it's not just like, okay, we put this into place. Now let's see what happens with vaccinations. He keeps trying new things. The team is obviously aware of where it's slowing down and what the new issues are. But I have a proposal for them, and that's that they take all of these extra vaccines we have, and what I am in favor of shipping them overseas to places where they're needed. But we also need to get them into prisons and assisted living places where there's not a resistance to the vaccine. They just aren't programmed set up to give it to them. And if we had our prisoners vaccinated, we could keep corrupt politicians in jail where they belong, rather than say, oh, for the sake of their lives, we have to get them out.
You're referring to one Sheldon Silver. Yes.
Yeah.
Who went home yesterday. Chris.
Well, I think the underlying question, I mean, the thing that has to be answered is, how do you convince the rather large percentage of the population that doesn't want to get vaccinated to get vaccinated? And I don't have an answer for that. And I don't think the Biden administration has an answer for that. I mean, you know, vaccine hesitancy is a real thing. And I think the people who have been willing to be vaccinated have been vaccinated, and the people who don't want to be aren't going to be unless, you know, something changes their mind. I do think that
could that something be, Chris, that we should make it mandatory? You want to ride on a subway? Mandatory? You
know, no.
Show your thing?
No, I don't think you can do that. Not in a free society. I would be uncomfortable with that. I think it has to be more of an education campaign. You know, I do think the government the CDC probably made a mistake with what was probably an overreaction to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is now, you know, available again. And by the way, I say that with my fingers crossed since
you're a recipient. Yes, right.
I'm not sure if I'm out of into the safe zone yet. But
our fingers are crossed for you too, Chris.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. But I don't know. But that isn't that the question? How do you convince people to get vaccinated when they don't want to?
Well, right, and to make the case, Bob.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's not like we have a light on our forehead that shines because we have the vaccine. And like Chris, I completely disagree with the notion of checking papers. I think that is like the freedom of speech conversation we had earlier, that is a slippery slope into an area that we really do not want to go in.
Don't we do that with measles? Don't we tell the kids they have to have a measles vaccination when they come to school?
Yeah, but that's different than riding the subway or, you know, that's go ahead, Bob.
No, you hit it right on the head, Chris, is that I do view it differently because it's both the populations and the capacity for spread. So I do look at it as different.
We're talking about tens of thousands of human lives here. There are some people who say, well, I don't want to take that vaccination. Why not? My president told me not to, or I think he wanted me not to, even though he's done it. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, we see what happened in India right now. They thought they had it under control. They've been killed. I think sometimes you have to take exceptional moves.
Well, even if I agreed with you, which I don't, but even if I did, I think the political backlash to that would be so significant that it would be damaging in the long run and probably hurt the cause in the long run.
I mean, we couldn't figure out how to do a mask mandate, for goodness sakes. Right. I mean, I don't know how you would do that. I mean, operationally, how would it happen?
Well, I don't know, Joe. You know, the mask mandate seemed to work pretty well. In my little town, you can't walk into a store without a mask on. It may not be a mandate. It may not be you're going to get arrested without it. But if you walk in, even accidentally, and I have, they're going to yell at you. And everybody's going to – there's going to be a need to keep masks on everybody. I think the same thing with vaccinations. Sorry. I know this puts me in a deep minority.
Well, it's probably unconstitutional, for one thing.
Yeah. Well, it's unconstitutional.
I don't think you're an I don't think you're in a minority. I think you're absolutely correct that in this area, I think there's much more acceptance of mask wearing. I think in other areas that it's actually you're actively normed against it. I mean, look at what's going on in Florida. The other point, and this is this I think part of the most troubling, because it says something about a rot in the American culture, is the vaccine isn't about you. It's about everybody else. It's about making sure that you're not spreading it to your grandparents or your neighbors or your friends. And this whole anti-vaxxer movement really has become placing the individual above community, and that's really dangerous for the future of the country.
Rosemary?
I'm trying to think of what I can add to this. I have reached the point where I don't care, that it seems that whether it's mandated or just a matter of education, there's a sizable amount of the population that doesn't want to get a vaccine, that doesn't think it's important, that doesn't even really believe COVID is real, as amazing as that is. And I have been reading history to look at what happened with the flu. I don't get flu shots every year, although I may now after what's happened this year. And so we even had the scare. We even had the scare of a pandemic, and that's not moving people to do what is so obviously the right thing. I was reading about Japan today, which has done extremely well managing the disease.
Right.
And part of the reason for that is that so many Japanese people wore masks anyway to defend against transmission of germs. It was not a big deal. So if reason doesn't do it, I don't have any hope that education will. I think that forcing people to will just bring out all the crazies that we've seen, like in Michigan. So I don't know. I think that what I want to say is that I'm going to just make sure that the people I know and care about and love are protected and doing the right thing. And that means vaccines and masks and probably booster shots in the future.
I was struck by what you just said I assume we read the same story this morning in Japan, which had to do with the Olympics, right? Of what a great job that Japan had done early on.
Yes.
Now the concern, of course, is that you're letting in all the other countries. So now what do you do to keep everybody safe?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And of course, that's the same dilemma that we're all facing, because that's a huge public relations and business boost, and they don't want to lose it, even though there's this huge risk associated with that.
It does. Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
No, I was just going to toss this out to ask people's opinion on. One of the things I've noticed is that I've actually been healthier wearing a mask. I haven't had the same level of colds that
allergies,
I usually have.
Yes.
The allergies are different.
Right, I know.
I mean, part of what we should be talking about is, how effective masks are for keeping us as a population safe. And that is getting back to the Japanese culture and what they've been able to do. So thank you for interweaving that.
So quick question, panel, in our 4 minutes before we go to a break, do you think the Olympics should happen? Chris Churchill, you're up first.
Well, sure. I mean, why not?
Yeah.
Well, I can actually come up with a lot of why nots.
Yeah, I can come up with a lot of why nots too, but...
But I mean, I think they can probably be done safely. I don't know. You put me on the spot. Part of me says, is it really worth it? I mean, is the Olympics so important that that it's worth the risk? But on the other hand, we're playing baseball. We're playing, most professional
right.
sports are playing. So why shouldn't the amateurs play?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, one of the questions is bringing everybody from across, all over the world to one place. Bob?
Yeah, no, I actually don't think it should be. I need to put my biases on the table, Joe. I'm not a huge supporter of the Olympics. I think it's become too corporate and has really moved away from being truly amateur. But if I was in Japan and part of their emergency management, their homeland security folks, I would be urging not to bring these populations in, especially given the level of success and safety that they're enjoying.
Are you at work or at home right now, Bob?
I am at work.
Okay. So SUNY, right?
Yes.
Do they have a can of WD-40 that we can get for your chair?
I apologize. I will move my seat.
They have some
and,
sort-
uh,
And Joe, WAMC will spring for it.
Yeah, we'll send over a courier, Bob. We want you to just checking.
I will move to a less squeaky chair. But you know what they say about the squeaky wheel.
That's true. Absolutely. Rosemary, what do you make of the Olympics?
Okay, so you realize that I care a whole lot more about the Gates divorce than I do about the Olympics.
Yes, as do I, but go ahead.
That said, I don't see any reason it can't be held off another year. Things are getting better in many places. It's already off the every 4-year schedule, so why not hold it next year? And in an abundance of precaution, call it off this year when we still don't know whether people are safe.
Yeah, it's hard to figure. Alan, your thoughts?
No.
Don't have it, right? Yeah. And it seems like, I mean, going back to referencing this article that I think was in the Times this morning about Japan and dealing with this, is that the decisions, of course, they have are to do it, to postpone it, or just to cancel it altogether. Some countries, North Korea being the one of the largest, of saying, you know, we're not going to participate. But many of the other countries are just sort of standing back and watching and waiting to see what's going to happen, with many athletes still training, but not sure if they're going to be going or not. So, I mean, it isn't until late summer, so it could certainly, a lot can change from now to then, but it is obviously a decision, it seems, would have to come sooner rather than later. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. panel@WAMC.org, and we will get to more topics. We will talk with our panel members, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. Plus, we will also go to your letters, and we're going to move on to other topics as well. Panel@WAMC.org. We will hear some news from the BBC and return after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Going to some of our letters, Miles takes a somber tone. Yes, vaccines are required for children to attend school. They were for me and they are for my children. And that is exactly what should be mandated. If we make a COVID vaccination a mandatory part of children getting an education, few parents would hold their children back by not vaccinating them. Yes, there are anti-vaxxers, but they are there already. Forget trying to preserve the adults that refuse to protect themselves. Let them die out, and the population of immunized people will eventually replace them.
Wow.
Yeah. Just for a moment.
Very amusing. Wow.
Yeah. Levi says, seems a little harsh, but there we go. Levi says, I side with universal vaccinations. However, in regards to showing papers, how would you feel about showing papers to vote? Also, Tom says, we seem to forget our food is inspected, our water is tested, we can be fined for spitting in the subway. There are clean air regulations, seatbelt laws, and milk needs to be pasteurized and let out of gasoline. Public health works when all well. When all is well, it's because public health works. It's not unconstitutional. All right. And let's see. Okay. I think that is it for that. So let's go to, let's go to Giuliani and his legal bills. This is an interesting story. As Rudolph Giuliani faces an escalating federal investigation and defamation suits, his advisors believe he should benefit from a $250 million Trump campaign war chest. We're going to build a wall of lawyers, and Trump's going to pay for it. As a federal investigation into Rudolph Giuliani escalates, his advisors have been pressing aides to former President Donald Trump to reach into a $250 million war chest to pay Mr. Giuliani for his efforts to overturn the results of its 2020 election on Mr. Trump's behalf. The pressure from Mr. Giuliani's camp has intensified since FBI agents executed search warrants at Mr. Giuliani's home and office last week, according to people familiar with the discussions, and comes as Mr. Giuliani has hired new lawyers and is facing his own protracted and costly legal battles.
Well, if we know anything about Trump at all, we know he's not giving any money to anybody. On the other hand, we do know that Rudy Giuliani has in the past said Trump could not turn on him because he knew too much. So so how far that extends, I don't know. But that is a classic sort of rats in the corner trying to bite each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Rosemary.
Yeah, I agree. I love watching this all happen there, and they're all fighting among themselves, the evil ones. I think that I think Michael Cohen is right that Giuliani is going to flip faster than a pancake on Trump, and I hope it results in an indictment. And I don't care if his bills are paid or not.
Bob Griffin.
So I really like this story. I entitled it "Booty for Rudy," though. I think the fact
cute and with double meaning. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. I think the fact that he's looking for Trump to give up any of his money is absolutely hilarious. There is absolutely nothing in Trump's history to say that he would back. Back Rudy with any bit of money. In fact, he walks away from his friends when they need him the most. I also, as I was reading the article, I know I'm taking making a light of it, but I was trying to think of things we could do to help Rudy get the money for what's, I think, going to be a very expensive few years for him. And I was thinking about, you know, a GoFundMe campaign, or, you know, a Rudy bake sale, or representing Four Seasons companies across the country. I mean, it'd be just fun to think of these things. But on a serious note, though, I do think that this Rudy situation is going to be linked with what seems to be developing as a pretty high level of corruption in the Barr DOJ. And that is something that we do need to take seriously.
Chris.
Well, of course Trump should pay his legal bills. He absolutely should, at least for the legal cases that involve the election. I mean, that money was raised explicitly for the legal fight to prove that the election was fraudulent. And it shows what a big scam that was, that Trump hasn't used any of that money to actually prove his case. Instead, he's using it as a war chest to kind of, you know, go after the Liz Cheneys of the world. Well, I think most people who donated that money would like to see it used to defend Rudy Giuliani in this defamation suit that he's facing. You know, if what Trump says is true, then use this defamation lawsuit to prove your case and prove that there was no defamation. Instead, he's, you know, this is another example of Trump just leaving basically allies to dangle on their own. You know, it's walking away from his debts, essentially, again.
But what makes you think that'll change? I mean, character is character.
Nothing. I don't think it'll change, but he should pay. For once, I can say that Team Giuliani is right, that he should have these legal bills paid by that war chest. Of course he should. That's what that money was for.
As I have said many times, should schmud.
Well. Why isn't he being charged with fraud then? I mean, it would take somebody who had standing to do that. But Chris is right. That money was raised as a legal defense fund, and Giuliani, pitiful as it was, provided legal defense.
Well, I think because if you read the fine print, you know, it did say that, well, we may not use it for that. But most people who donated didn't read the fine print. So they probably have their legal basis covered. But it doesn't mean it's any less outrageous.
Bob?
Again, remember, we're talking about a family that is prohibited from running nonprofits in the state because of past corruption. So this is totally in keeping with what we've seen from the Trump family. I'm just more amazed that Giuliani actually thought that that he would be able to get some money for this. It's going to be a cold day in a different place before he sees a cent.
So my heart blows blue borscht for Giuliani.
Blue borscht.
Let's not make a hero out of him yet.
So help me. I know this has a lot of twists and turns, and it's very difficult to keep track of all of this. But wasn't there a time right before, as the waning days of the waning days of the Trump administration, the last 3, 4, or 5 days, when he was still, you know, holding on there, and there was a great deal. He seemed to be blaming Giuliani for all of this, for not doing this, and so are they even friends anymore? Like, is that a? I don't know. Are they still buddies? I don't know.
Do you think Trump is a buddy with anybody?
No, I don't.
And we certainly remember his other good buddy, Mike Pence. Remember him? He could not stand next to the president without kissing his rear end. And he did everything that guy wanted him to. And now if there's a way that Trump can punish Pence, he's doing it.
The last we heard was when he banned Giuliani from helping to defend him against the second impeachment.
Right.
So, I'm not sure that there's been a rapprochement since then, has there?
Well, and not that I'm aware of. I don't know. I don't know what that's such a weird tangled web. I don't really understand. But it was one of the things. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I don't know either. But I think Andrew Giuliani, the son of Rudy, mm-hmm. who's talking about running for governor, is still close with Trump. And I think so. There, it's not like it's been a complete break.
Well, at least there's that. at least there's that relationship. Good. I'm glad to hear it. Let's go. Our final.
You're not going to vote for Andrew Giuliani? Joe?
I don't know. He's still that kid pulling on the sport jacket. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't. I know. Yeah. I've seen him. I know he's grown up, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Netanyahu, let's talk about this. It'll be our final topic for this morning as we have about 4 minutes left. The prime minister's opponents may now get a chance to oust him from power, but it is too soon to write off Benjamin Netanyahu, who is certainly a political survivor. He has failed to form a new Israeli government, prolonging deadlock. And the question, he basically had a midnight deadline that came and went. So now we look at and see where this goes and what happens and what the chances are for a new government there. Alan.
I knew you were going to do that.
Okay.
No, that's okay. You shouldn't be sorry. But I've watched this closely for a long time now. Sure. The president, Rulin, is going to say, I'll find somebody else to form a government. Who? And will they have the ability to do that? If Netanyahu couldn't do it, who can do it? And they're really kind of split here. So I don't see what's going to happen necessarily. I'll tell you right now.
Bob.
It also points to continued instability in both Israel and the Middle East, which is really concerning. When you look at the number of groups that would have to be woven into an anti-Netanyahu government, it's a really heavy lift, and it's either going to be an absolutely gorgeous quilt or it's going to be an absolutely impossible mess. But I am not optimistic about the ability of them to bring together that disparate group, even with the anti-Netanyahu movement. It is about bribery and corruption. It's about Netanyahu staying out of jail. But I will toss this out
you know, imagine if we had to go through five presidential elections since 2019. It just must be horrible.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And the irony here is, of course, that the one way that they thought that Netanyahu could save himself was by negotiating with the Israeli Arabs. And apparently that didn't work. Because that's the exact opposite of where his strength is with the Israeli populace, you know, defending the country from the encircling Arabs. And that didn't work this time.
Rosemary.
Well, the real problem here is that Bibi is very astute at knowing the weakness of his enemies, and he knows that they hate him, but they also know that how vain and power-seeking they are. So that's what he did the last time when Gantz was supposed to form a new government and came very close, and then Netanyahu says, okay, guess what? You can share power with me, and you can even be you can have my job for a year or so. We'll see what happens. And, of course, Gantz goes for it. Netanyahu stays in power, and he broke his promise to ever share power at all. So has he lied enough that the other party leaders who are not as strong and certainly not as dominant as him will believe him, or do we continue on as before? And then, of course, the other thing is what that jury will decide as far as his corruption trial. If they find him guilty, then things change a little bit, too.
All right, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for writing to us and for participating this morning. Alan, thank you as always. Thanks to Chris and Bob and Rosemary. I appreciate it very much. Coming up next, the Congressional Corner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.